in the union were there. The panel finally, in my view, reached an improper finding of equivocal evidence of carcinogenicity in male rats, which means, strictly speaking, there may be a connection between the exposure to the chemical and development of cancer. There may be a connection, but weaker, obviously, than clear evidence of. But far different from no evidence of, which is what fluoridation proponents like to go around saying, that there's no solid scientific evidence. Well, there are a number of epi studies, now the latest of which is the Bassin study, Burke and Yamiana's studies, and then a number of animal studies. And now we've got this substantial amount of evidence, all of which tied together with biological plausibility by Dr. Bassin in her fine piece of work, makes a very strong argument that this is a significant and reasonable scientific finding, and it should be the basis of public policy, at least in my point of view. But I'm just a civil servant, and I don't get paid to make that, and I don't get elected to make that kind of
thing. Well, of course, the thing is, I think if the American people ever stopped and realized that there is shocking increase in the incidence of many, many cancers, and here's certainly one definite cause, at least from the animal studies and from the Dr. Bassin studies and the study that was done by Dr. Dean Burke, who for many years was with the National Cancer Institute, and Dr. Yamiatis, and that was some years ago, showing, a significant increase in the incidence of cancer in communities that were fluoridated compared with not fluoridated communities. You would think that with all of this evidence and the fact that water fluoridation, as far as protecting cavities, has shown very little, if any, evidence of success. Certainly, dental hygiene is far better, but that's because of the fluoridated toothpaste, because fluoride's a deadly poison. It kills bacteria, it kills insects, it kills rodents, and in your mouth, it kills the bacteria. It does a good job of cutting down the bacteria flora, and that really is what cuts down the dental cavities, because actually, dental caries is a bacterial disease, isn't that right?
Well, I'm no expert on dental disease, but that's what I understand it to be the pathology of those kinds of things, is that bacteria grow in pits and fissures especially, which is where my understanding is something like 80% of cavities form in pits and fissures. Certainly, any fluoride in the tooth is insufficient for dealing with that kind of deep penetration of the bacteria.
We're going to be back in just a moment with Dr. William Hersey. This is such an important issue because I believe we're poisoning the American people. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly one of the other issues that really concerns me, and that is the fact that what they're putting into the water is really this hydrofluorosilicic acid that contains lead and cadmium and polonium 20 and arsenic, and as well as fluoride. And isn't there a significant increase in the blood levels of lead in areas where they put this in the drinking water?
Yes, there have been several studies. The most original of which came from Roger Masters and Myron Copeland, is a person I cited before, published in several different papers, results of analyzing blood samples, several hundred thousand blood samples of children in Massachusetts and New York, showing a very strong correlation between an increased risk of having elevated blood lead levels if a child is living in an area that uses hydrofluorosilicic acid, sometimes known as hexafluorosilicic acid, or the sodium salt of that acid as the fluoridating agent, versus no fluoridation at all or using sodium fluoride. But the presence of these byproducts from the phosphate industry, those people, youngsters had a definite increase in risk of having elevated blood lead levels.
But is there any safe level lead in the blood? I mean, doesn't this attack the brain and actually produce metal deficiency?
You're absolutely correct on that. In fact, that's one of the relatively few other materials that has a what's called a maximum contaminant level goal. That's a health-based standard in the drinking water. And by the way, I don't work in the drinking water office. I wanted to clear that up. I'm sorry if I made that left that impression earlier with you, Dr. Montes. But there are relatively few substances that have this health-based goal of zero that are not carcinogens. All the carcinogens have recommendations of zero. But the lead is one of the few not based on carcinogenicity that has a recommended health-based goal of zero because of that effect on the brain.
So, but then why are they adding it to the drinking water? If there's no safe level, why are they adding it to the drinking water? And do you think that the average doctor or dentist has any idea that when there's no safe level, that it's actually being added?
Well, apparently the lead that is responsible for these increased risks is not so much lead that's coming in directly with the acid as it is that some chemical breakdown product of the acid, the hydrofluosilicic acid, is making it easier for lead that the child is exposed to otherwise, conceivably through exposure to lead-based paint and that sort of thing, that lead, which most of which might pass ordinarily right down the gut and be excreted without being absorbed, the acid is perhaps causing an increased absorption of that lead as it moves down the GI tract and before it's eliminated, bringing the lead into the bloodstream and depositing it. So there's a scientific plausibility for that, for a mechanism for that to be happening. And you're right. It does not make any sense if
you... Hold that thought right there, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Dr. William Hersey, and we're talking about the fact that the studies have been done, and they find that in communities where they use this hydrofluosilicic acid or a salt thereof, and this is really what is used in about 91% of all communities that have water fluoridation. You think they're putting in sodium fluoride? No, they're not. 67% of America's communities are fluoridated, and 91% of those that are fluoridated use the hydrofluosilicic acid that contains lead and arsenic and cadmium and polonium 20 and fluoride. It's a byproduct of the what is scrubbed out of the chimneys in the phosphate manufacturing industry. It's too toxic to vent into the air, according to the EPA. It's too toxic to put into streams or rivers or take out and dump in the middle of the ocean. So they've come up with a solution. They put it in our drinking water. That doesn't make sense.
You're absolutely right. That's it in a nutshell. There is a direct correlation between, for instance, sometime in the last year, my recollection from Chemical and Engineering News, a publication of the American Chemical Society, pointing out a shortage in fluoridation chemicals because of a low demand for phosphate fertilizers or reduced production of phosphate fertilizers at any rate, which means exactly what we've been saying. The fluoride fluoridation chemical is a byproduct of the phosphate industry. When the phosphate industry is down, so fluoride production is down, and there are shortages for fluoridation chemicals. But yeah, most people would think if the authorities are putting this fluoride stuff in the water, it must be the same good fluoride that they put in toothpaste, right? And the answer is wrong. It is definitely not that pharmaceutical-grade product. It's an industrial byproduct. What's in toothpaste has to pass a very strict testing and control limits by health authorities, but including the levels of contaminants, which is the most significant a piece of that. And what goes in the drinking water is right basically straight from the somewhat cleaned up but nevertheless a waste stream from the phosphate fertilizer industry, instead of doing something else with it, like converting it back to calcium calcium fluoride and handling it as a toxic otherwise waste. They get to sell it and put it in our drinking water.
Well, Kirsten, what Dr. Hersey was saying is that if you analyze the blood levels in children in areas where they're using this material, the blood level is increased, and yet there is no safe level of blood, safe level of lead in the blood in children, because it's toxic to the brain. The reason for it is somewhat in question, but the finding is definitely there, and nobody seems to be concerned, because most people have no idea, and I'm certain most doctors and dentists don't understand that, but you actually cover that in some of the material on your website, don't you?
Yes, we have definitely cited the work of Masters and Copeland on this matter. That's very significant work of those two fellows. That added to what we think is otherwise a very convincing pile of evidence showing the risks associated with this practice are far outweigh any minuscule benefit, if there is any at all. We need to have a public hearing on this matter and get this out, get it before the Congress, get it before the public. And when all the facts are out and the public hears what the facts of the matter are, and when the Congress hears that, then this issue can be resolved in a reasonable way. But when all the decisions remain behind closed doors with all kinds of strange goings on in some of these cases, I sat in on the review that produced the 1993 National Academy report, and it was in some respects, watching sausage being made. It's not something you really want to do. So we think that everyone should know what the science is behind this practice, and basically what we know about it is that it's pretty dangerous, and we think that it's time to do what most of the rest of the Western world has done, which is say, we don't want this. Having done it for a while, we want to stop it and get off of this kick of using this particular industrial waste for that purpose. It can be converted to other uses, other useful uses. It can be used in the production of aluminum and so forth and so on. So, China has done some of that kind of work. So,
but even if we weren't using the waste material, the water fluoridation we're out of time. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're talking with Dr. William Hersey, and I was just saying that basically, even if you weren't using the industrial waste, and 91% of communities that are fluoridating, the fluoride itself, as far as doing anything at all, as far as, the dental caries, is there any significant evidence after 50, we started in 1950, so we're 55, 56 years into this experiment, is there any evidence that water fluoridation significantly decreases water dental cavities any better than simply good dental hygiene and the use of fluoridated toothpaste?
Well, actually, according to a Centers for Disease Control report issued in August of 2000, even the CDC and its parent organization, the Public Health Service, have to admit that topical application is the way by which fluoride exerts any beneficial effect on dental health. Far outweighing the so-called ingestion or systemic exposure. So the short answer is, if you brush your teeth, if you want fluoride, you can brush your teeth with fluoride, and that's what basically does the most good for dental health. It helps to remineralize incipient cavities. It interferes, as you said, because of its toxicity with the metabolism of oral bacteria. And so if you want to do your if you want fluoride and that's how you want to do it, that's the way to do it. It's effective. Spit it out. You're going to get some through your oral mucosa, but if you want to do it, that's on you. But don't put it in the community water supply. It's a toxic substance. It doesn't do as what it's supposed to have thought to have been doing all these 50-some-odd years when the government and the American Dental Association and other folks were promoting it. It hasn't been doing that. So let's not do that anymore. If you want fluoride, God bless you, take your fluoride, but do not put this toxic substance in the public water supply.
Because doesn't it have an impact on the brain? I mean, this is the frightening thing, is that we're giving it to children, and what do we know from the animal studies about the impact of fluoride on the brains of developing children?
Oh, that's the thing that has been troubling me most since 1995, when I became aware, especially of Phyllis Mullinex's work, with rats exposing rats at various times in their life cycle to fluoride. And when pregnant female rats were given fluoride that put fluoride into their blood level...
Well, hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Dr. William Hersey, who works for the Department of for the Environmental Protection Agency, not necessarily, however, in the division that deals with water safety. But he was just simply saying that one of the things that really disturbs him is the realization that fluoride in the water can have a profound impact on the brains of animals and of human beings. So why don't you pick up the story there, Dr. Hersey? I think this is so important, because if you're out there in the listening audience, you have children or grandchildren or even yourself, the thought that they're putting something in the water that could hurt the brain of developing children or children in utero is really a frightening thing. And yet, what do the scientific studies show?
Well, Mullinex's group showed that these pregnant animals exposed to fluoride that gave fluoride levels in their blood about equivalent to what would be in the blood of humans drinking water at the level of 4 milligrams per liter, which is what EPA has set as the legally enforceable standard. Those animals gave birth to hyperactive offspring, and the offspring remained hyperactive throughout their life. And when given to these animals at later life stages, it depressed their central nervous system activity. Phyllis Mullinex later described it in seminars as making the animals into couch potatoes. There had been similar observations done on the workers in the nuclear industry back in the early 1940s. I should say the mid to 1943-45 time period, working with uranium hexafluoride and exposed to fluoride by inhalation of that kind of central nervous system depression. And there's a long history of that. Chris Bryson's book, The Fluoride Deception, goes into it very well. But there's a host of other studies supporting Mullinex's work, published work was by Guan and co-workers, who's continuing to work in this field, by the way. He's at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden right now, showed the depletion of certain important brain chemicals in animals who were exposed to higher levels of fluoride. And then a study by Julie Varner and Carl Jensen and Isaacson and some other folks, Horvath, I believe was co-author on that paper, showed fluoride at 1 part per million in drinking water given to rats caused loss of brain cells, deposit of aluminum in the brain, apparently damaged the immune system. Because these animals exposed to fluoride died in otherwise unexplained circumstances, higher levels than the controls, apparently from disease. So this finding of adverse effect at 1 part per million in animals who are, for test rodents tend to be about 4 to 6 times more resistant to fluoride than humans are in terms of their exposure level being translated into serum levels. That's a very significant finding, we think.
Well, what about the Chinese studies showing that actually that you can knock 5 to 10 points off the IQ and if you are in an area with a significant level of fluoride in the water?
Yes, there have been several studies published in the late to middle 90s done in China, and then additional studies have been published recently. I was at a conference in Germany last fall where an extremely important study was published by similar workers who had published earlier in this field, tying together loose ends or other so-called confounding factors to strengthen the finding that children had somewhere between a 5 and 10% decrease in the average, and this was the average of the children tested at all ages from about 8 to age 13, which is as far as one carried the study out. This consistent difference, a negative difference of 5 to 10 IQ points in high fluoride areas. So that's a very significant finding. I don't know of any parent who would voluntarily submit his child to a 5% decrease in his IQ in order to pretend like he's benefiting his teeth by swallowing this toxic substance.
But, of course, the thing is, the average doctor doesn't know this. The average dentist doesn't know this. In fact, if you go up on the Internet and you go to PubMed and you begin trying to find out the things we're talking about, they don't carry anything about this. It's almost as if all of these studies are just non-existent. There is a journal there. You can track it down, the Journal of Fluoride, that has all of these. It's a peer-reviewed journal where they insert articles from chemists across the world. And there's a wonderful website called fluoridealert.org. Fluoridealert.org. Of course, they play games with your minds. If you go to fluoridealert.com, why, you'll get, of course, the website of the American Dental Association telling you how wonderful fluoride is. If you go to fluoridealert.org, why, you'll get the truth about really how toxic this is and how it impacts on the brain, how it impacts on fertility, how it impacts on the bones, how it impacts on the endocrine system, how it creates increased levels of Down's disease, and how it actually lowers the testosterone. What about the fertility studies? Have you looked into that at all, Dr. Hersey?
Well, I haven't personally done the studies myself, but I've certainly followed the literature, and there are host of data showing reproductive effects, adverse reproductive effects of fluoride. As you had mentioned, there's studies done in India linking dental fluorosis severity with decreased testosterone levels, and there's a positive finding there where higher exposures to fluoride exist, lower levels of testosterone in men. Then there was a study published by Frenny several years ago showing a threefold decrease in fertility in women who lived in areas where the fluoride level was, I believe, above 3 parts per million, which is a little bit higher than what the EPA recommend
advocates.
Well, that above, I used the wrong acronym there, is what the American Dental Association recommends and the CDC recommends, which is 1 part per million. EPA's legally enforceable standard, hold your breath, is 4 parts per million. But this standard of 1 part per million is certainly not safe based on the work of Varner and Jensen and altogether, the neurotoxic effect is something that's really really a mind-boggler to me.
And, of course, I've read Dr. Prenny's paper, and he found that the higher the fluoride level in the drinking water, the lower the fertility.
Right.
The lower the fluoride level, the higher the fertility. Well, we've got Theodore, who's on the line, waiting patiently here, and Theodore certainly is very involved with this whole issue right here in the People's Republic of Santa Cruz, where we both live. Hi, Theodore. How are you?
Hi, and let me thank both of you for doing one more show trying to help us get smart about fluoridation. And Dr. Hersey, I was part of the team that put in an initiative in the city of Santa Cruz against fluoridation back in 99. And I just want to just give you heartfelt thanks for the work you've done, because for me the most powerful testimony I can ever give when I go up to the city councils here in Watsonville is, what are the EPA scientists telling us, you know, the guys who we trust to look at our drinking water? And they're the ones we want to look at the research and feed it back to us and tell us. So when I can say that now we've got 11 of your unions saying stop fluoridating, I feel that's the most powerful thing I can say to these people. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that acknowledgement. But it's also, I got to say, it's really heartening to know that because we you know, take a principled stand on this, then that translates into something that the people whose lives are affected can use then in affecting the, you know, self-government in the way that it should be affected. So, working together, our labor unions and the public, that's the vision we've always had as organized labor inside EPA.
And, of course, for our listeners, again, the website is NTEU280.org. That's NTEU280.org. Go there, pull it down. It's perhaps 30 or 40 pages. Put it into a booklet. If you don't have access to it, it is available through Radio Liberty, but you can get it on your own, and we encourage you to do that. Read it through several times. You'll find fascinating material, especially Dr. William Hersey's testimony before a Senate subcommittee back in the year 2000. Theodore, did you have anything else you wanted to say?
Well, I did, because Dr. Hersey's information is half of it, and the other half is getting connected with the people in your community to put that information to work and fight against, to either stop fluoridation in your town if you have it, and to fight against it coming in. And that's what we're in the midst of here in Watsonville and Santa Cruz because of a recent court ruling. And I want to alert people in the listening audience, which is Monterey, Santa Cruz, and Watsonville areas, can I give a plug for another show?
Go ahead.
This is a show that Dr. Stan is on occasionally. It's called Perspectives. It's on Saturday mornings from noon to 1 on KSCO AM 1080. And people listening on the web can get it on the web as well. But tomorrow, Dr. Biles, who's a local holistic dentist and one of the only ones in our community who's openly come out and advocates against fluoridation, is going to be interviewing Jeff Green, who's the director of Citizens for Safe Drinking Water, which is a national organization fighting fluoridation, and he was certainly a key part in helping our community mount an initiative drive against fluoridation, which we were successful with, but again, through the courts and through the manipulations of the powers that be, our victory is under attack.
Okay,
so,
well, that is 10:80 tomorrow at noon.
Noon, and tomorrow listen in and get connected to your local people who are fighting this.
God bless. Thanks so
and,
much.
Oh, Dana. Bless you, too. Thank you both.
Okay, fine. Well, of course, this is going on all across the country. They are spending countless hundreds of millions of dollars to force this on communities. You have to ask yourself why, when it affects the fertility. It lowers the intelligence, has a profound impact on the brain, and at least in the animal studies, the animal is permanently hyperactive, and we see such an increase in attention deficit hyperactivity disorders all across America. And, of course, the government says, oh, we have no idea where he's coming from, but we can assure you it's not from the water fluoridation, why that's perfectly safe and effective. And then, of course, it affects the thyroid, and we see so many people with hypothyroidism. It softens the bone and increases the incidence of hip fractures. It affects the endocrine system, produces premature puberty as far as girls are concerned. According to Chris Bryson's book, The Fluoride Deception, in in New York, in Newburgh, New York. Newburgh, New York, where they started this in 1945, has twice the incidence of heart disease that they have in Kingston, New York, which is the parallel city, but nobody really seems to be too worried about that. We know heart disease is increasing. You can check if you want the reference to that. Chris Bryson's book will get it. And there's so much more. Dr. Hersey, it almost seems like we live in a world gone mad. I mean, where is the outcry from organized medicine and from organized dentistry and the people who should be there to protect us and to protect the health of the American people?
Well, that's a really good question, Dr. Montes. Our view certainly is that the evidence is pretty clear, and this doesn't make a whole lot of sense to be putting this toxic substance in our drinking water. We say that as civil servants who have certainly no interest in this other than, you know, fulfilling our duty to the public, which is to, you know, give to the public our very best professional judgment of the, you know, existence of the scientific literature on this. And that's what we've done. Now, what the policymakers do is subject to what political pressure can be brought to bear through the rest of the political process that our government has. So, you know, we do what we do. We're going to be trying to visit. We're going to be visiting the Hill here shortly and talking to some people up there about this moratorium issue. And hope to have some good news about that, but who knows where things may go. But we certainly want to explore that. We're going to do what we can do, but a previous caller was exactly right. It has to be translated into action and organization at the local level to bring pressure to bear at the local level, the state level, and at the national level on that.
And I think that I would urge all of our listeners, if you have access to a computer, you can go to that computer and you can actually pull down www.NTEU280, National Treasury, Employees Union, National Treasury Employees Union, 280.org. Get their information. Read it through. And then get it to your dentist and say, is it possible you've been lied to? Is it possible that there's another agenda? Why would they possibly be putting something in there that could harm our children? And all we can do is just hope that there are enough people out there who really care and will help us get the information out. Dr. Hersey is certainly doing everything he can. Another excellent website, fluoridealert.org. FluorideAlert.org is put up by, I believe, Dr. Conant, as I remember, and he is a chemistry professor, and he has links to all of the, literally hundreds of articles that tell you how terribly toxic this is. Are there any other websites or information you'd like to suggest for our listeners?
Capital L web dot org is another. Website that's called, which stands for secondlook.org. It's an organization that advocates taking a close look at some previously believed effective public health measures, taking a second look and making sure that we want to continue going down that road. And that organization picked water fluoridation as the first issue to work on. But they maintain an excellent bibliography, which has links over to Fluoride Alert. .org as well. Those of us in this movement try to stay hooked together as much as possible, and support each other's efforts to get information out. We look forward to making some significant progress here over the next couple of months.
Well, I certainly hope we can, because in my estimation, we are poisoning the American people. And you can go back and you can read the writings of Bertrand Russell back in 1953, and he said, you know, by diet injections and injunctions, the use of diet injections and injunctions will allow us to mold the minds of the children. And 4 years later, another gentleman said, this is terrible why we're destroying the minds of our children. Well, we've got Jim calling from Missouri. Hang on patiently. Jim, did you have a question for our guest?
Yes, sir. Two quick things. First of all, I looked on your website while the show was going on, sir, Dr. Hersey, and I saw that one of the legislators you addressed your letter to was Senator Kennedy. I'm about the same age as his son, who actually had that bone cancer that Dr. Stan talked about. He actually lost his leg.
Yes, that's right.
And he might actually be somebody that could be very helpful.
Thank you for that thought. Yeah, we had definitely plans to follow up on that issue.
He might be somebody that would be like that Representative Burton that had the autistic children was very interested in the mercury and the vaccines.
Yeah, everybody else? Yeah, I think that's a very good point.
Yeah,
well taken, Jim. Anything else?
One other quick thing. Have you ever seen or heard of the letter that was written to the Lee Nutritional Research Foundation in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, from the man who was running the IG Farben plant after the war? He said that the Nazis actually put the fluoride in the water in the camps.
Now that is covered in a book called The Age of Treason, and it's referenced in my newsletter. I think it was November of 2004, December of 2004. And yes, that is a very, very important letter, and you'll find it in the book The Age of Treason.
Well, I can offer you one quick thing just as kind of a validity for that letter. That was written to the Lee Nutritional Research Foundation, and Dr. Stan, you've probably heard of Dr. Royal Lee, who actually was a dentist, by the way. He's the man that started the Standard Process Vitamin Company. I don't know if you've ever heard of
it. No, I really haven't.
They've been around a really long time and so forth. But anyway, thank you so much for your work, Dr. Hersey.
Okay. Thank you so much for calling, Jim.
Bye bye. Bye bye.
And of course, the information is all there. In fact, we quote from that book, The Age of Treason, and this report that came from an American who went to Europe after the Second World War and was in contact with the IG Farben company and found that the Nazis fluoridated the water in the occupied areas, but not in their own areas. That the Russians put it in the drinking water in the Gulag, and you have to ask yourself why. What did they know that we don't know today, or maybe there's some people who do know? Well, we're just about out of time, Dr. Hersey. I want to really thank you so much for staying up late tonight and being with us here.
My pleasure, Dr. Stan.
Good night, and God bless you. And please keep us appraised of what happens when you go under the hill.
I'll certainly do that.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, well, I guess this evening, Dr. William Hersey, and he's, of course, back in Washington, D.C. It's midnight now, but he was kind enough to stay up with us. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and the story of water fluoridation is so incredible. Why would anybody want to put something in the drinking water that would hurt the minds of our children and alter the minds of our children and increase the incidence of Down's disease and actually lower the testosterone level and create infertility and erectile dysfunction and increase the incidence of cancer? And why would anybody want to do something like that? Well, all I can do is suggest, if you'd like to know more about it, we have a talk. It's called The History of Water Fluoridation, and there is a syllabus that goes with that has all the documents that you need to go into to understand exactly what's going on, because there is another agenda. In fact, the syllabus is called The Hidden Agenda, and I should have called it The Hidden Agenda Behind Water Fluoridation, and certainly we refer to not only the writings of Bertrand Russell in his book, The Impact of Science on Society, in 1953, and we actually have permission to reproduce several of the pages from that book, and of course, and then the reference to the book, The Age of Treason, which pointed out how the Nazis had very effectively used water fluoridation to control the populace. So, and then, of course, so much else in the way of references to Jacques Cousteau, who talked about the necessity of eliminating 350,000 people a day, and give you the source of the reference. And if you'd like to see the pages from the UNESCO Courier of November of 1991, where Jacques Cousteau makes that remark, well, we'd be glad to send it to you. Just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Chris Bryson's book on the fluoride deception is probably the best single book going into the background of water fluoridation. We actually at Radio Liberty carry 2-4 tape sets on water fluoridation, and we have my talk on the history of water fluoridation. Actually, another DVD put out by our good friend Dr. Kennedy, who actually has interviewed Dr. Hersey, who you heard this evening, and Dr. Phyllis Mullinex, and certainly other people. Actually, there's a doctor in Toronto who I've interviewed myself, talked to him on the radio. He wouldn't come on my programs because he is, of course, a professor of dental preventive dentistry at the University of Toronto, Dr. Limebach. And he told me, I can't come on your program. I've been threatened, and I will not risk my family and my profession to do this, but you can get my information on the Internet. It is there. They threaten people. They threaten to destroy them if they tell the truth. Now, why would anybody do that? Unless there's something more to water fluoridation than most people suspect. So our plea to you is get the information. There are ways of getting the fluoride out of your drinking water. If you'd like more information, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. But help us to get the truth out. If you'd like to get that report from the union, we do have it, but you can get it at the Internet site at 1-800-find-me-at. www.nteu280.org, nteu280.org, and then, of course, please pray for America. Pray for revival, pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so, until we're together again, may the Lord be with you. Stand back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we invite your calls from out across America at 1-888 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please don't call unless we ask for the calls, because, well, we're going to have a fascinating program. We have this Dr. John Cannell from the Vitamin D Council, and you probably have never heard of the Vitamin D Council out there in the listening audience, and I'll have to admit that I'd never heard of the Vitamin D Council until my good friend Bill Sardi put me in touch with Dr. Cannell. Basically, when I went to medical school, and I think when those doctors went to medical school, we learned about the various vitamins, A, B, there were three B vitamins, and then there were another couple of B vitamins, 5, 6, 12, but, you know, and then C and D and E, and but we were always told, you know, if you eat a well-balanced diet, you're going to get plenty of this, you got nothing to worry about. And, you know, if you take multivitamin, well, let people take a multivitamin, but, you know, it's not going to do much of any good anyway. Just eat a well-balanced diet, and that's all there is to it. Well, Dr. Cannell, of course, and the people he works with in the Vitamin D Council have an entirely different attitude towards vitamin D. And I think that you'll be fascinated by what he has to say. Dr. Cannell, thank you so very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Why don't you just go ahead and you pick up the story?
You know, the story of vitamin D is one that's just unfolding as we talk. For example, yesterday there were two papers published, one that showed that there was a good, sound theoretical reason to think vitamin D should help treat tuberculosis, and then the second paper published a couple of hours later showed that patients who have tuberculosis who were 10,000 units of vitamin D a day was added to their regimen, they had 100% cure rate. Now, I say this because it all happened within the last 24 hours, and because it's a disease that no one even thinks is in any way could be related to vitamin D, and yet that the field is unfolding that quickly. And it's almost a new story every day, from cancer to heart disease to stroke to dementia to depression. It appears likely that vitamin D plays a role in all those illnesses.
No, of course, the idea that the vitamin D would help in fighting tuberculosis is something that would be quite foreign to most doctors. You know, but of course, tuberculosis, it was certainly a plague when I was in medical school, and then it disappeared, and we saw very little tuberculosis for many years, and now in more recent years it's been coming back, and not only that, but a multiple drug-resistant tuberculosis, which certainly can be fatal. And so the fact that there is something that can actually help that is really, really rather exciting, isn't it?
It is, and this was a double-blind, placebo-controlled study that showed that it helped. And it also gives you a clue. If one wants to look for diseases that might be helped by vitamin D, one either look, you need to look to history or look to epidemiology. And whenever you find a disease that is more common in the winter, it's more common at higher latitudes, or that was effectively treated in the early part of the century when sunshine was was every good doctor in the country recommended sunshine.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan of the Vitamin... our guest today is Dr. John Cannell of the Vitamin D Council, and he's simply pointing out that there are certain diseases that are much more prevalent in the wintertime. And, of course, we might even mention one of these would be influenza. There's an influenza season. We don't see influenza usually in the summer. We see it in the winter. What's the relationship between influenza and sunlight and vitamin D?
Well, that story is unfolding. I mean, people have known for a long time that respiratory diseases, upper and lower respiratory diseases, many of the viral ones were virtually unheard of in the summertime and were common in the winter. In fact, the common cold got its name because it came on with the cold weather. And now just recently, there is evidence that vitamin D is involved in the production of what are called antimicrobial proteins. Those are your body's antibiotics, and they are so much better than any antibiotic a doctor can prescribe. They do not get resistant to bacteria. They are produced in right in the tissues where they're needed, and they're extremely active. There's more than 200 of these natural antibiotics that have been described. But people have been desperately almost looking for what is it that upregulates them, what increases their expression in the human body. And so far as I know, the only thing that's been found to clearly do that is the activated form of vitamin D. Again, this research came within the last year.
And so this is really all sort of new, and of course the thing is, what's the relationship for our listeners out there who may not be acquainted with really where vitamin D comes from? What's the relationship between sunlight and vitamin D?
Well, sunlight makes an incredible amount of vitamin D. In fact, when I tell you this, I'm going to tell you the fact that changed my life. 3 years ago, I was reading about various subjects, and I stumbled upon vitamin D, and I read the following fact. And the fact is this, is that when you go out into the sunshine in your bathing suit in the summertime, that you make up to 50,000 units of vitamin D within an hour. Now, that's about 250 times more vitamin D than exists in a glass of milk. And when I stumbled across that fact, I thought about it, and I read more, because the question came to me, why? Why would humans have developed a system that makes that much vitamin D so very quickly? And now, after studying about it, the answer is nobody knows, but God probably did it for a good reason.
Well, this is Dr. Stan Becker at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Dr. John Cannell, and we're talking about vitamin D. And, of course, well, what most people may or may not even think of is that every time you go out in the sunlight, why the sun actually hitting your skin, there's a substance there. I think it's called gesterol. You correct me on that. But there's a substance in the skin that when the sun hits it, it converts it into vitamin D. So you can actually produce your own vitamin D simply by in the sunlight. The trouble is that those of us who are inside most of the time, we don't get out in the sunlight, we need vitamin D supplements, and we develop the deficiency with all of the complications. Would that be a proper statement?
Yes, it is a proper statement. The more you follow most doctors' advice, the more vitamin D deficient you become.
Now, what is that substance in the skin that is converted into vitamin D?
7-dehydrocholesterol, or called precholecalciferol.
All right, fine.
Yeah. And one of the problems is that virtually every doctor you meet advises people not to go out in the sun. Sunlight has been as bad a thing currently as it was a good thing in the 1920s and 1930s. And one of the effects of that is probably for the first time in human history, we have now true cavemen. We have people who get up in their house in the morning, put on some sunblock just in case, get in their car in their covered garage, drive to work, and glass blocks out all UVB radiation. Then they park in a covered garage at their workplace, they work, and then they go home, and they reverse the process and go home. Now, cavemen never did that. They might have lived in a cave, but they were out in the sun a lot. So we have now people who go out of their way to never let a ray of sunlight strike their skin. And it's a huge naturalistic experiment.
And, of course, vitamin D is essential for so many functions in the human body. So I'm going to let you maybe perhaps tell our listeners where vitamin D is important. Who is an orthopedic surgeon, we knew that it played an important part as far as calcium metabolism, but that's simply just one small part of its function, isn't it?
Yeah, it's useful to think of vitamin D as a series of pools along a mountain stream. The very top pool, the most important pool, is to maintain your calcium economy, and that prevents your serum, your blood calcium, from getting too low. If you only have a little vitamin D in your body, it will all go to doing that, because that maintains your calcium, and if your calcium falls, you die. So that's its most important immediate function. But if you get enough vitamin D, there's a series of pools beneath this maintaining the blood calcium pool. And those are the pools that are now being explored very rapidly, and it's very exciting. But below that maintaining the calcium economy pool is a pool of preventing heart disease, of preventing and perhaps even being useful in helping treat cancer, in preventing and perhaps even treating some forms of dementia, to preventing multiple sclerosis, to preventing some forms of diabetes, to effectively treating some forms of hypertension. Depression, major depression has been shown to be have a vitamin D deficient component. Many of these diseases in the future, it will be like hypertension. One cause of hypertension is vitamin D deficiency. Vitamin D will not effectively treat all cases of hypertension, but within the population of hypertensive, there's certainly going to be a subset of people who simply have vitamin D deficiency and their hypertension disappears with adequate treatment. But beneath the top pool along this mountain stream are what looks like perhaps hundreds of pools of different functions of the vitamin D that only can occur if there's enough vitamin D flowing into the system to get past that top pool.
All right, fine. So it has a profound impact on so many aspects of our life, and this is something that most people don't think of, and even most doctors don't think of, this idea that we really don't want to get out in the sunlight because we might get skin cancer, and yet, of course, is this really true? What's the relationship between sunlight and, regular skin cancer and then melanomas?
Sunlight increases your risk for non-melanoma skin cancer. That's squamous cell and basal cell cancer. And about 1,500 people a year die from those cancers. Those cancers are generally a nuisance if you see a dermatologist on a regular basis. Occasionally one will slip by, but generally the people who die from those cancers are people who ignore growths on their skin for many, many years. So those cancers are clearly associated with the sunlight. Many dermatologists are convinced and try to scare patients into believing that melanoma, another form of skin cancer which kills about 8,000 Americans a year, try to convince us that that's in fact caused by sunlight. And in fact, the two biggest, best, and most recent studies in fact show probably the opposite is true. That in some ways that sunlight is protective against both the development and the progression of melanoma. That's one thing that sunlight does is age your skin, and that's a fact. Anybody can tell that from looking at people who spend a lot of time in the sun. And I think in some ways that's a very important fact, because oftentimes people will care. I don't really care that much about cancer or heart disease, but if it's going to make me look older, I don't want any part of it. Well, I think a lot of people stay inside and stay out of the sun because they don't want the sun to age your skin. And that's why supplements are so important.
All right, fine. Well, somebody just called in, wanted to know if milk was a good source of vitamin D. Is it, do we really need supplements on top of that?
Yes. If you drink about 40 glasses of milk a day, you'll get enough vitamin D.
And not very many people are going to do that, of course. And
yes.
And besides that, a lot of milk is certainly not good for males, because
right.
We know it increases the incidence of prostate and other cancers. And you really need to, because that's a subject for an entirely different program. So certainly we need the supplements. Now, in what form would we get the supplements, and how much should the average individual be taking?
Yeah, obviously I didn't mean for anybody to drink 40 glasses of milk a day, but some people just assume that if they drink a glass or two of milk a day, they get enough vitamin D, and they do not. They get basically a homeopathic amount if they drink a couple glasses of milk a day. So you can't get it from milk. You can get it from your diet if you eat a lot of fatty fish, mackerel, salmon, and sardines. But other than that, unless you're willing to have mackerel for breakfast, sardines for lunch, and salmon for dinner all the time, you really can't get it, because vitamin D was never made to be put in your mouth. It was designed to be made in your skin. And so if you're going to go out of the sun, if you're going to stay indoors and not let the sunlight strike you, you have to take vitamin D supplements. How much you need to take depends a lot upon the latitude you live at, depends upon your body weight, it depends upon your race, and it depends upon your age. Because even though you avoid the sun, virtually everybody gets some vitamin D from incidental sunlight. It's reflected up off the ground, et cetera. So there's a lot of controversy about how much is needed. But the government says that 2,000 units a day is safe for anybody to take without being under a doctor's care. And that's a good start for many people, and that certainly won't make anybody sick or toxic. And it's not enough for many people, but it's a lot more than most people are taking. So I generally recommend people take 2,000 units a day unless they understand what they're doing and unless they've learned something about the physiology of vitamin D. And particularly if they get their blood levels checked periodically. There's a blood test called a 25-hydroxy vitamin D level, which I predict will probably be the single most important blood test in preventative medicine in the future.
Well, of course, when I went to medical school, one of the things they taught us about was vitamin D toxicity. And, we were told there's certain people who take massive amounts of vitamin C, and then they begin to get, I've forgotten whether it was hypercalcemia. That was one of the causes of hypercalcemia, because a vitamin D we used to use 50,000 units of vitamin D twice a day, made twice a week, and nobody ever seemed to get into trouble with that. In fact, you could take probably 50,000 units a day for several months without getting into trouble, although you probably wouldn't want to take that indefinitely. Would that be a fairly accurate appraisal or not?
That is very accurate. The upper limit of toxicity is probably somewhere above 10,000 units a day for years and years and years on end.
Well, now, it's 10,000. Do we really need up to 10,000 a day?
Nobody knows the answer to that question. When you get up to doses like 10,000 or 50,000 units, we're talking about the use of vitamin D as a drug. And that's quite different from the use of vitamin D to prevent certain illnesses or to make sure that you have an adequate immune system. For example, the dose used with the tuberculosis patients that was reported yesterday, that's using vitamin D as a drug, and I predict it will be a very effective drug in a wide variety of situations. But you probably know the story about the drug. If it can't be patented, not many people are interested. And vitamin D is costs next to nothing. Nobody's going to make any money selling vitamin D. Nobody knows how much you need. But you know, uses of 10,000, 20,000, 50,000 units a day will be what we call pharmacological uses, and without a doubt, there'll be many more diseases other than tuberculosis that will be shown to have beneficial effects from vitamin D.
All right, well, our guest is Dr. John Cannell from the Vitamin D Council. We're talking about the beneficial effects of vitamin D. It's sort of something that most people don't really think about too much, and yet, of course, it's something that we should have a lot more. And where are we living in a normal life where we're out in the sunlight every day? Well, I would be getting, of course, a good dose of it. However, in the wintertime, even if you're out in the sun, why? Because the sun's low on the horizon, you don't get the full impact. Well, we're going to be back in just a couple of minutes, and we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Dr. John Cannell. Now, what about what part does vitamin D play in calcium metabolism? You talked about the pools along the stream, and the first one was certainly calcium. What's the relationship between vitamin D and calcium metabolism?
Well, the vitamin D has two main functions in the body. One is called the endocrine function of vitamin D. And the second one is called the autocrine, or perhaps paracrine, function of vitamin D. Endocrine just means that some organ in the body makes a hormone that is circulated by the blood. And so when you go out in the sun, or when you take vitamin D supplements, they are absorbed in your intestine or absorbed in your skin, and then they're eventually converted in the kidney to a hormone called calcitriol, or activated vitamin D. Now, activated vitamin D is one of the most potent steroid hormones in the human body. And it acts to regulate calcium by increasing calcium absorption, decreasing calcium excretion from the kidney and the intestine, and other things that help maintain the calcium economy. But a lot of people don't understand or think of vitamin D as a steroid hormone, but it is, in fact, it's as much of a steroid hormone as testosterone or estrogen or progesterone or any steroid hormone. Steroid hormones are simply any substance that has a sterol base and that acts to turn your genes on and off. And that's exactly what vitamin D does. It works by turning genes on and off. That's a profound mechanism of action.
Well, now, would it have the same effect as the androgen or estrogenic hormones? Would it affect any? Would it affect any of our muscle function or our athletic function?
Well, that's a great question, and since it's not a sex steroid, it doesn't have the masculinizing or feminizing effects of the sex steroid. But there is a compelling amount of literature that shows that it improves muscle function. Now, that data is mostly in older people, but I'm personally convinced that there are a number of young people in this country who are vitamin D deficient whose athletic function would improve significantly if they took the right amount of vitamin D. And I stress the right amount because the studies also indicate if you take too much, that sort of impairs muscle function. That it would improve athletic function. There's evidence that it improves people's musculoskeletal abilities in lots of ways, from muscle strength to coordination to reaction time and balance. Decreases the number of falls in older people. And if you talk to anyone who's been up on this for a while and who's maintained their vitamin D levels in the optimum range for a couple of years, they'll all tell you the same thing. They'll tell you that they are quicker and that they seem to sort of be on the peak of their game all the time. In fact, in the coming newsletter, I'm going to talk about the athletic and the possibilities of athletic improvement with vitamin D. But the fact is, the steroid hormone is very, very important because that makes it's unlike any other vitamin. And the fact that it works by turning your genes on and off tells you that it has a possible mechanism of action in any disease you can possibly think of.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here with Dr. Canal. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Dr. John Canal. We're talking about vitamin D, and of course, vitamin D apparently acts in the body by turning genes on and off. Now, genes are what make the amino acids, and the amino acids make our proteins, and so, if you can control these genes, of course, you can get them to do what they want to, well, you can really alter function. There's certain master proteins, substances, or even in this case, a steroid hormone that will actually impact on the function of those genes. This probably will be the wave of the future, don't you think, really, as far as medicine is concerned?
Yes, I do. And it's important to understand that what we're talking about is not taking extra steroid hormones so that you get an exaggeration of what the hormone does, like when people take extra testosterone or other kind of anabolic steroids. It doesn't work that way. You're either at an ideal level or you're not. And if you take too little or if you take too much, you will not have what is normal function in many ways. And the best way to know what normal function is simply look at what normal levels should be, is simply look at what the species, what level has the human species had for the 2 million years it's been on Earth. And you can know that by simply drawing the blood levels of people who live and work in the sun. And when you do that, you find that people who live and work in the sun, such as lifeguards or people who live around the equator, they have blood levels that are about three times higher than the average modern American.
Well, then, are they healthier than the average normal American?
Well, if you screen out, you know, if you go down to the equator and you screen out the diseases that kill people quite frequently, childhood diseases and stuff, then you look and see what the incidence of multiple sclerosis is, or the incidence of heart disease, and the incidence of hypertension, the incidence of a number of different diseases. And anytime you find a latitudinal variation, if the disease gets, if the incidence increases the further away from the equator you go, you have a clue that there is a significant contribution of vitamin D. But your direct question, you know, the people who live around the equator live longer. That they do not, and it's not. It's because there's so many other factors that affect it, poverty and a number of infectious diseases that apparently have no relation at all to vitamin D. And I'm sure there's many infectious diseases that vitamin D will not help you at all with.
Well, of course, you've mentioned certainly the possibility of tuberculosis. Do we know of its impact on any other type of infectious disease?
We don't, and of course, there's this one study about tuberculosis, one controlled study, so that obviously has to be confirmed and repeated. But it appears likely that vitamin D, in terms of infectious disease, is going to be effective wherever there is an inadequate amount of natural antibiotics, and that's mainly in the lung and to some extent in the intestine. So I imagine the main impact of vitamin D in infectious disease is going to be in respiratory diseases.
Well, of course, we hear this idea of colds. Colds come in the wintertime, flu comes in the wintertime. And, of course, most people, when they have their cold, they say, oh, I'm going to take a lot of vitamin C. Should they be taking vitamin C and vitamin D, do you think, or do we have any studies to that effect?
No, there aren't any studies I'm aware of that looked at that. And one of the problems, of course, with vitamin C is for it to be an effective antimicrobial agent, you have to maintain very high blood levels for a period of time, and they're hard to obtain with oral doses of vitamin C. What we're talking about with vitamin D is a question if you took enough vitamin D to maintain your blood levels in the winter like they are in the summer, what would happen? And if you talk to anybody who has discovered this and who has started to take adequate amounts of vitamin D, they'll tell you the same thing. They just don't get colds and flu. And when they do, it's such a mild case, you're not even sure that you're sick. You kind of can feel a little bit of discomfort, a little bit of scratchy throat, a little bit of nose, etc. But you just don't get toxic like some people do with influenza. Even with the common cold.
So, of course, there are no controlled studies on this, but it's really empirical, and the people who take fairly amounts of vitamin D, during the fall and winter, that's certainly something to do, start thinking about, because, you know, sometimes people are laid up for a week or 2 weeks or even longer after influenza.
Yes. Actually, there are some studies. There's several studies using UVB light or sunlight and comparing the incidence of respiratory infection. Sure, sunlight has a reduced incidence of the symptoms of respiratory infection.
Hold that thought right there, please. Okay. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Dr. John Cannell of the Vitamin D Council, and of course we're talking about, of all things, vitamin D, but this is something that, most people don't think about, and yet there is so much evidence that it really is essential, and that specifically in the wintertime, we're not getting adequate supplies of this. And you were saying that there really have been, then, these studies that show that ultraviolet light on children does decrease significantly their incidence of colds and other respiratory diseases during the winter months?
Yes, there are. There were a number of studies about this in the 20s and 30s. Some of the studies conflicted, and then there have been some more studies two in the United States, one in 1945 and one in the 80s. And then there have been a series of studies in the Russian literature where they would especially irradiate children with or workers with ultraviolet radiation of the wavelength that creates vitamin D. Then they would just check to see what the absenteeism rate was or what the reported symptomatology was. And all of the studies that I've been able to find so far all show an effect. There was also one very interesting small study that was reported in 1992 where a doctor somewhere in the tropics simply noticed that there were lots of children with subclinical rickets who were getting one infection after another, one respiratory infection, a cold or whatever. And he took a group of them and gave them 60,000 units of vitamin D a week for 6 weeks. And luckily, you're an experienced physician, so you know that's not very much, but to a lot of people that sounds like it's a huge amount, and it's really not. But what he noticed and what he reported, there was in that group of children who took the vitamin D, their frequent respiratory infections totally disappeared for the next 6 months.
Here's for our guests out there why rickets is a disease of children who are not getting adequate vitamin D for one reason or another, and of course then they begin to get bones and really suffer abnormal development. And of course, I don't think I ever saw a case of rickets here in the United States. I probably saw a few of them when I practiced in Africa, but it's a relatively rare disease because most of our children get vitamins. You know, mothers get vitamins, children get vitamins. Do you think that this is really warded off most rickets here in the United States?
Yes, rickets is up close to the top of the mountain pool. You don't need a whole lot of vitamin D to prevent rickets, or the adult form of rickets, which is called osteomalacia. But those diseases are intimately involved with maintaining the calcium economy.
So hold that thought. We'll be right back.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we were simply talking about rickets. Children used to get rickets, and in certain parts of the world they do, especially if they have black skin, and they cannot absorb the vitamin D sunlight normally. But here in the United States, rickets is not a factor. It was many, many years ago in areas, but now ordinarily most children will get a vitamin of some sort, a multivitamin, that'll have enough vitamin D in it so that they're not getting rickets. But then we were talking about the osteomalacia, which means osteobone malacia softening. And osteomalacia is a disease we see of older people where they have softened bones. Now, will adequate doses of vitamin C tend to decrease the incidence of osteomalacia?
Vitamin D, if the osteomalacia is secondary to vitamin D deficiency, then vitamin D will cure the condition. It can also be secondary to inadequate calcium intake, but that's rarer. Osteomalacia actually often presents as painful bones. A number of people who have been diagnosed with chronic pain syndrome, fibromyalgia and others, can have osteomalacia. And you can make that diagnosis clinically by seeing if they have significant increased pain with pressure on their bones, either in their sternum or their tibia and fibula. Treatment for that particular condition is very rewarding. There's also, just again, to get an idea of the spectrum of diseases that we're talking about, we started talking about tuberculosis, and we haven't really spent much time talking about cancer, but chronic pain. There have been several studies now that indicate that a significant amount of people with just chronic pain, chronic low back pain, what we call idiopathic pain, where the doctor just can't find out why it hurts so much, and a number of those people will respond to adequate amounts of vitamin D. Sometimes when I talk like this, I know people must be scratching their head and thinking, this is just not possible. You know, all these different diseases, I've heard this before with vitamin E, or I've heard vitamin C, or I've just heard it before. And it's one of the most difficult things to get across is the incredible amount of research that's being done on this as we talk. Nobody really knows what the extent of this hormone and the deficiency of this hormone, and what the extent of it is, and what the ramifications are. But the story is quickly unfolding in the scientific literature.
All right. Well, let's go to a caller, and we'll just put our number out. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. But right now we have Barbara calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Barbara. How are you?
I'm doing just fine, thank you. Enjoying the program very much. I was wondering, you touched on the issue of mood. But would people who use, like, these sunlights during the winter months to prevent, you know, this despondency and the depression that they get from the lack of the sunlight, would they benefit from the use of vitamin D as much as they would, say, from the sunlight?
Well, nobody knows for sure. There's one study that directly looked at that issue. They took a number of people with seasonal affective disorder, which is what you're speaking of, and
right.
They gave half of them intense light therapy, what's called full spectrum light. That has no ultraviolet light in it, so it doesn't produce any vitamin D. It's full spectrum light of the visible spectrum. So half the patients got high-intensity light treatments, and the other half got a single injection of 100,000 units of vitamin D. And when they looked at the patients 4 weeks later, the cure rate was actually higher in the vitamin D group. Now, I'd like to caution you by saying that I'm a psychiatrist by practice now, this is not a panacea for mental illness, although I would no longer ever think of treating a patient for any sort of mental illness without checking his vitamin D status and supplementing than I would, you know, making sure he didn't drink an adequate amount of water. I mean, it's basic to a lot of things, and I've seen a number of people, especially with mood disorders, who after they've been on vitamin D for either several months or sometimes it takes even longer, a year or so, their mood disorders are much, much improved. This is even though it's a potent steroid hormone, in many ways its effects are rather subtle, and you have to have adequate vitamin D nutrition for a while, and you'll almost always see an improvement in your mood. You'll see an improvement in your fingernails; those lines, those ridges, will go away. Your dentist will congratulate you because you're flossing twice a day, finally, like he wants you to, and you don't have the nerve to tell him you're not flossing at all, but gingivitis virtually disappears with people with adequate vitamin D nutrition. These things take time, but they're dramatic, it's by far the most rewarding supplemental approach I think you can take to your health.
Anything else, Barbara?
No, so you're suggesting that long-term supplementation, you know, is far better than the huge dose.
Yes, huge doses should be avoided, except
right.
when the drug is used by a physician for as a drug. Huge doses are not physiological. It's best to get your vitamin D like your ancestors got it, and that's by getting the right amount every day. And you have to learn about the physiology of vitamin D. You have to have some idea of how much you're going to make in a day if you're in your normal activities. So if it's in a winter time, for example, and you're at a latitude where there's no ultraviolet B radiation in the atmosphere, you know you're going to have to take more than if you're outside in the summer and you're at the beach or you're playing tennis or you play golf. And then, of course, in those days, you wouldn't have to take any at all. So it takes some sophistication to understand this nutrient and to use it the correct way.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, fine. Well, that was Barbara calling from Santa Cruz, and if you're out there and you have a question for us, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Now, one of the things, of course, we used to be besieged with as orthopedic surgeons was the entity of osteoporosis, which is it's simply postmenopausal osteoporosis in women seems to be related, of course, to a lack of sex hormones and cause softening of the bone, very much like osteomalacia. Certainly, histologically, it was somewhat different, but one was related to vitamin C. But does vitamin D have any relationship to the treatment of, or any part in the treatment of postmenopausal osteoporosis?
Yes, it does, but I think its effects there are probably less dramatic than about any other disease I've mentioned. And the reason for that is because osteoporosis can occur for a wide variety of reasons. As you mentioned, just the withdrawal of the sex hormones, whether it be estrogen or testosterone, can induce vitamin D, can induce osteoporosis. But, it requires an adequate calcium intake. It requires an adequate magnesium intake. It requires adequate amounts of vitamin D to prevent it. It requires vitamin K to prevent it. And perhaps more important than any of those is that modern human diets have result in a mildly metabolic acidosis in the body. And that acidosis, if any cook can tell you how to get the calcium out of a bone, that's to put it in the pot and put a little vinegar in, and that'll leach out. So that acetic acid and the vinegar will leach out the calcium. Well, modern humans, because our diet is so poor in vegetables in particular, and because we're so high in processed food, we have a chronic metabolic acidosis that our ancestors never had. So many of us sort of live in mildly acid pools that leach the calcium out of our bones. So there's so many things. A lot of people think, well, if I take adequate vitamin D, I won't get osteoporosis, or my osteoporosis will go away. And vitamin D is one of many factors that are needed to be addressed in the treatment and prevention of osteoporosis.
But you're saying that an alkaline state of the body would be better than the acid state of the body.
Yes, the body is naturally adapted to a mildly alkaline state.
All right, because certainly then, are you suggesting that maybe up to 2,000 international units of vitamin D a day would be a good dose for the average individual? I mean, I think that, what is it, about 400 units that the government advocates?
Well, the government advises people under 50 to take 200 units, the people between 50 and 70 to take 400 units, and people over the age of 70 to take 600 units. And that's only for the prevention of osteoporosis. When those recommendations came out in 1998, it's clear that they were only saying this is what the science shows that may be helpful in preventing osteoporosis, this dose of vitamin D. Not to say that was the only thing that would prevent osteoporosis, but that was proven to be one thing that was a factor. They didn't address any of these other diseases because they just didn't have adequate amounts of data to consider them. And since that meeting and the Food and Nutrition Board met to formulate the current recommendations, there's been an explosion of literature about this substance. And most people think it's time that the Institute of Medicine and the Food and Nutrition Board look into this subject again and revise their estimate.
Well,
but to answer your question, 2,000 units, you're within the government guidelines for safety. They say up to 2,000 units a day is safe for anybody to take. So if you take 2,000 units a day, that's certainly probably better than what you're taking.
And do you think then that there would be an element of certainly a benefit from taking an adequate dose?
Yes, that will not be an adequate dose for some people. It depends upon, it won't be an adequate dose for many African Americans. It will not be an adequate dose for many older people because they have both impaired absorption from their intestine and because they cannot make vitamin D from their skin as well. But 2,000 units a day would be a gigantic leap forward for just about anybody's health.
Well, of course, as a physician, I've noticed that blacks seem to age more readily than whites do, and certainly we know that they die much at a younger age, by a fair amount, to the point where most of blacks don't collect their Social Security, whereas most whites do. Do you think that vitamin D, a large dose of vitamin D, a couple of thousand units of vitamin D for blacks would really help them? Is there any evidence it might prolong their age?
That's a very interesting question, because if you look at the diseases that differentially kill African Americans compared to whites, the list of diseases is almost identical to the list of diseases that is now being associated with vitamin D deficiency. And I think it is probable that the main reason there's this huge inequity between the life expectancy of whites and African Americans is because if you're African American, the chances of you being vitamin D deficient are virtually 100%.
Well, I think that's really very interesting, and I do hope that our African-American listeners will pay attention to this. I think this is a very important factor, and certainly it would only be logical that this is would certainly be playing a part in that, because, of course, the black like the white. Most of them are not out in the sunlight, and if they are out in the sunlight, they're still not going to be getting the amount that they need. Certainly, if they were, living in the equatorial area, it would be entirely different than living here in the northern, more temperate climates.
Yeah, one of the ways you know how important vitamin D is because humans who do live in equatorial climates develop a very black skin. They can make all the vitamin D they need through that skin if they're out in the sun. But when about 50,000 years ago, when some humans started to migrate to the extremes of the equator, to the extremes of latitude, it was remarkable how quickly skin lightened. I mean, from an evolutionary point of view, that change occurs very, very quickly, and it has to, because if you have very dark skin and you're living at 60 or 70 degrees latitude, you're going to be very vitamin D deficient. So that those changes occur rapidly.
Well, now, of course, you mentioned that as a psychiatrist, you actually check the vitamin D levels in your patients. Do you notice that? I don't know the makeup of your practice, but do you notice that blacks have a tendency towards a lower vitamin D level than the whites?
Oh yeah. On the average, their levels are about half of whites, and there are large studies that show that. Average, it depends on how the test is done and the methodology used to measure 25-hydroxyvitamin D levels, but anytime there's a comparison, African-Americans have average levels of about 50% what white levels are.
Well, I think that's really fascinating. What about the element of sphincter control? Does inadequacy of vitamin D play any a part in that?
I'd be surprised if it didn't, but I know of no studies that indicate that it does, because vitamin D is so involved in muscle function.
How is it? Is it involved with muscle function because of its relationship to calcium, or does it have a direct effect on the muscle itself, the steroid effect?
Right. There are vitamin D receptors in muscles that actually, very interestingly, actually respond as much to 25-hydroxyvitamin D as it does to the activated form of vitamin D called calcitriol, or 1,25-dihydroxyvitamin D. So muscle has a sort of a unique role in vitamin D function. And when you certainly anyone who pays attention to this and starts to maintain and to obtain first and then maintain adequate vitamin D health, they'll notice an improvement in muscle function, but I know of no studies in terms of sphincters.
Well, guys, one of the interesting things, we watch the Olympics, rather the Winter Olympics or the Summer Olympics, and you have superb athletes. I mean, you have, amazing, abilities, and yet, of course, I was watching some skating the other night. There were 400ths of a second difference between the winner and the loser, or the second person who came in second. Do you think that the vitamin D would in any way enhance muscle function? Because you only need a little bit of edge, of course, to be the winner. And, of course, there's certainly laws against taking any sort of androgenic or pre-androgenic hormones. But what about vitamin D? Would that play a part?
Well, I mean, I don't see how they could regulate it, because you could just go out in the sunshine or go into a suntan booth and you could get it. But the answer is absolutely. I think that there are a number of German and Russian studies. When I researched this for writing a paper, I went and looked at the literature and found there was in the late 40s and in the 50s in the German and Russian literature, there was an enormous attention paid to ultraviolet light and athletic performance, and there were a number of studies demonstrating that it improved the time on the 100-meter dash, and we're talking taking 5 to 8% off of a fairly well-trained athlete's time, reaction time, powerlifting, muscle strength, et cetera, training ability. And I'm convinced that you and I sound about the same age, and I'm sure you remember in the 60s and 70s and 80s, What countries came in 1 and 2 year after year in the Olympics?
Of course, the Russians did.
East Germans and the Russians.
Right.
And why? You know, they don't anymore. But I'm convinced that one of the reasons they did that is because their scientists knew about the effects of ultraviolet light, if not the effects of vitamin D, and I believe those athletes were in peak vitamin D nutrition when they competed, although I have no way of proving that.
Now we're going to be back here just to wrap up our program here in just a moment here with Dr. John Cannell of the Vitamin D Council. Well, Dr. Cannell, how can people get in touch with your organization and keep abreast of these fast-breaking things, events that are happening?
Google the Vitamin D Council when you come to our website, and you can sign up for our newsletter there.
And is this an email letter or what?
Yeah, I send out an email letter, yes, an email newsletter.
And how often does it come out?
When I can get around to writing it.
You're sort of like I am. Of course, I'm in a position I have to write a newsletter every month, and I will tell you that really gets to be a drag, but, it also requires a certain amount of self-discipline. So.
Yes, it does. I try to put one out at the beginning of every month, and it's a free newsletter, so people understand that it's a little bit late. Sometimes it gets a little too long because I address a certain issue that an academic, certain faction of the vitamin D academic community is interested in. Other times it's more general issues. The most popular newsletters I have are the ones where there are questions and answers, and I'll try to do more of those.
And do you think there's an increasing awareness of the part that vitamin D plays, in our physiology, on the part of physicians across America? Or are you trying to increase that awareness?
Yeah, I wish. I wish that were true. I don't know if you know the history of beriberi, for example, or some of the other nutritional diseases. Modern medicine fought for years and years and years and decades against the idea that inadequate nutrition could cause any disease. And the claims that are being made about vitamin D now, I know, are going to turn off many physicians. They're going to just say this is simply not possible, and they're going to dig their heels in. I wish that I could be hopeful about modern medicine looking at the recent literature and evaluating it objectively.
Well, I think the exciting thing, though, is if you have the scientific backing, why are you going to begin to get people at least thinking along these lines? And this is really so vitally important. And certainly, there's so much research going on today that validate these points. It's just a matter of being able to get them into the hands of our physicians and the people working in the medical field.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, well, we've just got about 40 seconds before I let you go. Is there any parting thought that you would have for our listeners tonight?
The safest thing to do is to get safe sun exposure in the late spring, the summer, and the early fall, and then to take 2,000 units of vitamin D a day, or maybe even a little bit more during the wintertime. That's the safest advice I can give you.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so very much for being with us. I know it's getting a little late down there. But anyway, thank you so very much, and I hope maybe we can get you back on our other programs so you can keep us abreast of the rapidly changing field.
I enjoyed it.
Good night. God bless.
Good night.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we try to get on to health issues, and certainly Dr. John Cannell is one of the leading experts on this field. He works here in the state of California, somewhat south of where we are. We actually have, of course, I think some excellent material on health and health issues. Certainly among them would be our good friend Dr. Russell Blaylock's book, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. I know my wife uses that almost as a Bible because it's got so much information in there, and there's so many harmful things that they put in food, and they conceal what they are by changing the name. So Dr. Blaylock has done a great job of telling you all the various names that they'll give to the MSG and soy products. And then, of course, he's written the book Excitotoxins, The Taste That Kills, and his latest book, Natural Strategies for Health Patients. So that's Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. excitotoxins, the taste that kills, which really goes into the background of the NutraSweet, which, of course, was a deadly poison. They put it in our food. And you say, oh, I don't believe that could happen. Well, you really need to read the scientific studies, and certainly Dr. Blaylock lists them there. We actually have a great deal of information up on the Internet, and certainly Betty Martini's website. We'll give you doorway, DORWA.com. We'll give you the source of all of the scientific studies, produces pathological obesity, the impacts on fertility, and certainly it produces cancer. They know all of these things because there are people in government who have a different agenda. And we can thank Donald Rumsfeld for getting us in over the objection of all of the health scientists back in 1981, and they've been poisoning the American people for 25 years. And one of the things that these produce, and of course these would be things like aspartame, NutraSweet, and of course MSG products, they produce pathological obesity. Oh my goodness, look at all those fat people. It's because, you know, they're just eating too many hamburgers, or it's the colonel's fault, or no, of course, much of this is aspartame, they know that. They put out all this propaganda just to confuse you, and they confuse you intentionally. So we recommend, of course, Health and Nutrition Secrets Can Save Your Life. Excitotoxins, the taste that kills. Health and Nutrition Secrets, I should say Natural Strategies for Health Patients. And if you know somebody who's going to be going in for chemotherapy, I know we had a woman called us the other day. She was so grateful because her daughter or her daughter-in-law had actually going in for chemotherapy, used these basic strategies, and her hair didn't fall out. She didn't get sick. The doctor couldn't believe it, wanted to know what she was doing. And of course, the patient didn't tell him that she had read Dr. Blaylock's book. We have a 4-tape set with Dr. Blaylock. We have 4-tape sets on the statin drugs that are poisoning the American people, on magnesium. We have an excellent book on death by medicine, death by RX by Dr. Strand. So much information there. If you'd like to know more, why give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, and then we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family and help us as we've reached out 5 hours every day. And then pray for America, pray for revival, but please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty. Again, our number, 1-800-544-8927, 544-8927.